This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio program is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. The United States is built on the mythology of a meritocracy. That is, if you work hard, you can achieve your dreams. But this ideal leaves out historical and current inequalities, particularly those that are racial. Study after study shows that if you start out as wealthy and white, you can achieve far more than if you start out as black and poor. A study that is the basis of a new book tracked hundreds of American families, black and white, middle class and poor, over the course of many years. That book is called Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. And its author, Thomas M. Shapiro, now joins me. He is the Pocross Professor of Law and Social Policy at the Heller School at Brandeis University, where he directs the Institute on Assets and Social Policy. He's also written several books. His earlier ones include The Hidden Cost of Being African American. Welcome to the program, Thomas.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. You are not African American, although you write a lot about race and the inequalities that are based on race. Tell us about this study that is sort of a longitudinal study. You tracked over 100 families over the course of many years. What sorts of families did you track, and why did you pick those families?
Sure. So, we first started interviewing families in 1998 and 1999. We ended up interviewing a little less than 200 families. We wanted to look at how families were planning for their futures, and especially for their children's futures. So all the families that we interviewed had young five-year-old children about to enter kindergarten. So they were making school choices, housing choices, community choices, and thinking about their peer and their social networks. Most specifically, we wanted to look at how their family wealth shaped the kinds of plans they had and what they were thinking about. So that first set of interviews started in 1998, and we wanted a sample of families that were about half white, half African American, half middle class, half poor or working class. And we sampled them in three cities, Los Angeles, St. Louis, and Boston. And in each of those cities, also, about half of those we interviewed in those cities were in the urban areas, and the other half were in the suburban areas. So that was the sample we wanted to look at to see what was happening in different communities, especially how family wealth was helping families to strategize for the future or blocking the aspirations that they have.
So what were some of the sort of ideas, if you can give us some examples, particularly among the poorer families, the ones that just didn't have as much wealth to build upon? What were the aspirations they had for their children, for where they lived?
So great question. You know, one of the things I was most amazed by in that first set of interviews was the amazing similarity of aspirations that parents have for their families, especially their young children, in terms of the kind of life they're seeking for their children, the kind of educational goals they have, and maybe more than anything else, the ability and willingness to sacrifice for their children, sacrifice maybe some of their own comforts for their children's future. And this is in 1998 and 1999, when the children are 5 years old. Luckily, very fortunately, we were able to re-interview the exact same families 12 years later, when those children, if they'd stayed on track, would be about seniors in high school or planning for college or dropped out or whatever happened in their lives. And that was a really intriguing and a very central question in the social sciences about how advantage and privilege and disadvantage is passed along between generations.
So there were families that I'm assuming had dreams of their children going to good schools and having the basis for then being able to go on to good colleges. I assume a lot of them hoped to maybe move to better neighborhoods, etc. Was that about the kind of common theme that you saw in the first set of interviews?
Absolutely. And I would add to that, another common theme really hit at some of the what I would call racialization in American society that we were seeing. Largely, almost wholly among white families, when we would talk to them about the kinds of neighborhoods that they were interested in living in and why they wanted to move where they were currently living, almost always that conversation in a roundabout way came back to race. And it came to who their neighbors were, what they saw, quote, moving into their communities, more families of color, often scared some of the white families that we were talking to, not all by any stretch of the imagination, and most of all, they were concerned about the peers that their children would have in school. So we saw that came through pretty clear in the first set of interviews.
Wow. And what about the Black families in terms of the neighborhoods that they aspired to live in?
That was also a challenge. So there's one particular story that it may take me a minute or two to tell.
Sure.
Of a woman, a young African-American woman in St. Louis, in the north part of the city, buys her first home. It's really a rundown home where the front door really doesn't even exist. She's got to buy it with her first couple of paychecks. She's a new urban professional, and she hangs a door. She puts windows up. She starts to prepare the house, and it's in a very decayed neighborhood. I don't know if your readers can vision St. Louis, but it's almost like Katrina that's never been renewed or fixed up, where a lot of houses look like they've been bombed out, even to this day. Well, this woman is a pioneer. She's a community builder, and she helped build the community around her. And when we re-interviewed her 12 years later in 2011, when we got back to her, her community had started to improve slightly, but the home value of her home was nowhere near worth the wealth for her it would have been had she moved to the suburbs, which she could have many, many years ago. So the case often with African-American families is that they more often choose to live close to the communities they were raised in or the next community or two closer to the suburbs. But almost, I don't want to say never, but very rarely do they live with white counterparts who have the same income, the same professional status.
And is that because they choose to or that they are unable to?
Well, it's both a push-pull. It's where families are going to feel comfortable. It's where real estate agents to this day continue to guide and steer families of color into neighborhoods that are much less homogeneous white, into bordering on majority of families of color. And we know that from a lot of even Department of Justice studies to this day. Mm. But it's also a matter of comfort for families. Almost no one wants to be the first of a kind in their neighborhood. People don't mind being the second, third, fourth, or fifth, but the first is a very different task.
So let's talk about what you found in terms of whether the people you interviewed had achieved their sort of their own personal goals in life. Jobs are a huge issue, right? I mean, what were you told by many of these families? I'm particularly interested in, of course, the African-American families. What were you told by them about their aspirations for their own careers or jobs or earning potential? And then what did you find 12 years later in terms of any difference between their goals from 12 years before and the reality of where they were?
Wow, great question. Let me try to attack it in a couple of different ways. Between the first and second set of interviews, the Great Recession happened in the United States in late 2007. And that really wreaked havoc on a lot of plans that most American families had. And the short story is that impact of the Great Recession had a much deeper, worse impact on African-American communities than it had on white communities. And it deeply impacted white communities as well. But what we saw is that the African-American family tended to be unemployed sooner, the duration of unemployment lasted longer, and significantly, when they found work again, it was at lower wages than they had before. So with that great crisis, part of my analysis is that those African-American families, even the middle-class African-American families, hadn't been able to build up enough financial wealth or assets to protect them from the mishaps of the economy and sometimes some personal and medical mishaps that happened along the way. Now, all of this also occurs in an era that you know, by the title of the book, I'm distinguishing where I think we are now in the United States, an era of toxic inequality, distinguished from the run-of-the-mill, usual kind of inequality that has always been with us in the United States and probably always will, to some extent or another. And toxic inequality for me is distinguished by the following characteristics. We're seeing absolutely historically high levels of both income and wealth inequality, and all the data point to that, and the families that I talk to, that resonates in their pocketbooks and their bank accounts as well.
And can you give us some statistics of the sort of difference wealth and income between whites and blacks in the United States?
Sure, absolutely. So let's start with some basic wealth inequality. The standard figure that we use now, coming from some of the best economic thinking, Piketty and Sayas and others, tells us that the wealthiest 1% of American society owns 42% of all of our financial wealth. And that is at historic highs. When we look at the racial wealth gap, that is taking a measure of what's the financial wealth of a median, half above, half below, that typical white family compared to the typical African-American family and Latino family, this is what we see. The typical African-American family has 8 cents in wealth for every dollar of wealth that the typical or median white family has.
8 cents? Latinos, that's less than 10%.
8 cents in wealth. Yes, I know.
Oh my goodness.
I'm glad this figure continues to startle people. It should shock us to right down to our foundations, and it gives us a whole lot to think about. For Latinos, it's about 9.5 cents on the dollar.
Wow.
And embedded in that is a lot of historical legacy, a lot of contemporary discrimination in current policy and institutions, and it all kind of winds itself together to produce that outcome.
And we know, for example, that a white and a black person with the exact same qualifications, but one with a white sounding name, the other with a black sounding name, have very different results when they go for job interviews. We know that in schools, subconscious racial bias impacts black kids more. We know, all of these things where women of color are involved, they get the sort of double burden of gender bias and racial bias. We know in terms of housing, getting access to loans, all of these factors. We know incarceration, which of course can throw off a person's life course dramatically and usually permanently, impacts black folks disproportionately compared to white folks for the same crime. So, and of course, the historical legacy of slavery and of our border, all of these have an impact, right? I mean, when you have family wealth, you're able to build on family wealth so much more than if you start out with low family wealth. So all of these factors play a huge impact.
Absolutely. And I would add to that, one of the greatest transmissions of inequality and disadvantage in the United States is family inheritance. White families inherit large amounts of financial resources from their parents or grandparents at about 8 times the frequency that African American families do.
And does even that take the form of simply like housing? You know, so if white families might be more likely to own their own house, and so then can take out mortgages based on their house to pay for their kids' college, etc.
Absolutely. So in the first set of interviews and also in the second set, but in the interviews we did in 1998, another really illuminating piece of data for us was that almost all families that were homeowners, whether they were white or black, almost all families that were homeowners received significant financial help from their parents for the down payment. It was an era, and still is, where it's very difficult for young families and young professional or working families in particular to gain enough wealth to put it down, plunk it down as a down payment. We just don't have that in our bank accounts, especially as
Thomas,
young people.
Thomas, I'm in the exact same position. My parents had to help me and my husband buy our home, and we wouldn't be living in the home we live in now had my parents not helped us with just a down payment on a house. That's it.
I hear that. It resonates very clearly with me and a lot of people we talk to as well. But most families are not that fortunate,
of course,
to have parents and grandparents that can pass that along. And that goes into to understanding why it is that African American families might have only 8 cents on the dollar for every dollar of wealth that a white family has. So that's the kind of data that I get into in Toxic Inequality, and I tell it through the stories of the families that we had the great opportunity and honor to talk to over a 12-year period.
What did you find among the white families in terms of their own reflections about how they did? I don't know if in your study you went there, because a lot of times we see perspectives on many social issues be sharply divided by race. And unfortunately, often, not all, but often a lot of white Americans simply don't see the historic reasons for inequality because they don't experience them themselves, or they don't see themselves as privileged, even if statistics bear out that they are.
That's absolutely correct. And we were able, I think, to get fairly deeply into that kind of psyche in many of the interviews that we were able to do. So one interview in particular I can recall for us, where it was a young couple in St. Louis, and they wanted to move out of their community, and clearly they were quote, bothered by how the community was becoming more families of color, and it really wasn't a large number at all, but it was still worrisome to them. They started holding garage sales every Sunday. And you know what a garage sale is. We're trying to sell our old stuff, and it runs out after a month or two of garage sales. So they were sitting at dinner one night where her mother was over, and they were talking about their plan for their daughter and moving to this, quote, better community, a better school, more further south down the Mississippi River, and things would be greater and nicer and all that. But they didn't have the money for the down payment. Their garage sales were running out. Well, their mother reached into her pocketbook, pulled out a check, and wrote a check for $30,000. Now, I think that's great, and that's wonderful. We all should have parents like that. But later in the interview, when we asked that same couple to tell us the story, how they bought that house, a very different story emerged. It was like historical amnesia. They didn't even mention the $30,000 check for their down payment. And so in the interviewer, we kind of called them a little bit on that. Said, remember earlier you talked to us about that great gift from your mother? And the couple flipped it around and said, well, we deserved it. We deserved it because we worked hard and we're holding garage sales. Now, a lot of people hold garage sales. Hundreds of thousands of people, I dare say, hold garage sales to try and get some cash together for something. And people work hard, and that's a second or third job or not an entrepreneurial activity, but they don't have the mother that can write the check for $30,000. So it was interesting how she flipped the American notion of deservedness into not as if she had actually earned it, but she, quote, deserved it because she had, quote, worked hard.
And, you know, Thomas, this is part and parcel of this ideology that we cling to, despite so much evidence to the contrary, that the wealthy in America are wealthy because they deserve it, and the poor are poor because they simply don't work hard enough.
That's absolutely correct. One family we interviewed, also in St. Louis, it was the wealthiest family in terms of the kind of inheritance, and it was up close to the $2 million range that they either had already inherited or were about to. And in the interview with Carlene Clark in 2011, when we were asking her how she sort of felt about that inheritance and the money, her words, and I can paraphrase, I thought were very striking, especially when we asked her where she thought the family would be in 10 years. And she said something like, oh, we're going to be on good because we make sound financial decisions. Now, anybody that has $2 million has a very different context and situation for making, quote, sound financial decisions. And the
implication, you don't have to go to a payday lender to get to pay rent, which you can, you know, judge and say that that's not a sound financial decision, except if you have the money, you wouldn't need to be making those decisions in the first place.
Absolutely. And she was clearly implying that they were doing as well as they were because she was making sound financial decisions and other people weren't.
You know, I really feel like so much of what your book concludes is so relevant in our political context that we live in today. The Republican Party today has as its basis this ideology, this mythology of a meritocracy. And so the stripping of social safety nets, the attacks on affirmative action, on any sort of welfare programs are based on this mythology. And, you know, millions of people, say, losing their health care is seen as a good thing. Your research bears out that it's not a good thing. So much of our own sort of American perspectives on this issue is also relevant if you look at the kinds of people that voted for Donald Trump. Not just poor white Americans who feel like they were losing out because of the racial resentment they felt against immigrants, but also wealthy, educated white Americans. A majority of educated white American women voted for Trump. Can you apply the conclusions of your study to the way in which our political context has played out over the past year or so?
Sure, I can try, and that I would say is really the entire conceptual framework of the book is really built around the scaffolding of answering questions that you just raised. Maybe not specifically for the current election, because I think it goes further back in time and is much deeper and is going to survive past the next election. So the other parts of toxic inequality are that this has been an era now for 20 years of stagnated family living standards, of stalled mobility. And in conjunction with the heightened historic levels of inequality, what the media and politicians have been doing for several decades now and getting away with it is pandering to racial anxieties, explaining or trying to explain the big distraction, if you will, is the attempt to explain, to scapegoat on immigrants, on ethnic groups, and with racial anxiety, the real pain that most Americans are feeling because our standard of living has stagnated. And we see those above us, the very top 1%, doing so much better. And it doesn't look, you know, we're working really hard and not getting any reward for it. That has been weighing, I think, and finally,
is there a sense that we're not acknowledging the rewards? Just as you said that people were sort of a little bit in denial of their own privilege, do you see the strain among white Americans that perceives themselves as suffering and struggling, even though they're still demographically the most privileged group?
I think at some level that's really accurate. My sense at the same time is that within the context of toxic inequality, I think the fact is that almost everybody is feeling some pain and struggling, and the hardships are real. And different groups are situated differently and feel that at a different level. So families of color feel the same, but they're impacted even more deeply and even more robustly. White families are impacted as well. And I think, I'm not sure, you know, we're sitting here today where Congress is going to attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which will deny health insurance to 24 million more people. It's going to make premiums that much higher and will have the impact of making inequality worse. It is going to have the impact also of widening the racial wealth gap, because it's going to take more wealth away in terms of families having to pay more for their premiums. They're going to have to reach into their bank accounts to do that. That's going to impact families of color much more greatly. So it's part of the current context. And you know, I think you're right absolutely about continual attacks on the safety net in the United States, healthcare in particular. You know, I don't know in whose world not having a whole society with healthcare is a good thing. It happens.
The 1%, the 1% who can afford to buy their own healthcare, and members of Congress who get government healthcare. They're the ones who don't care about our healthcare,
yes,
right?
Yes, they do.
Well, Thomas, I want to thank you.
Same system.
Yes, exactly. We should all be so lucky to have the same healthcare as members of Congress do. Thomas, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you very much, and great luck on the show.
Thank you. Thomas Shapiro is my guest. He is the Pocross Professor of Law and Social Policy at the Heller School at Brandeis University, where he directs the Institute on Assets and Social Policy. He is the author of several books, including The Hidden Cost of Being African American. And we've been talking about his newest book, Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.